Good morning. If I can have everybody grab a seat if there are any remaining, and also just as a form of courtesy, if I can have you turn off your cell phones, I would really appreciate that. It's just a friendly reminder. I am going to call this meeting to order. Please call the roll.
Aguirre, Arambula, Arapostathis, Donovan, here. Fletcher,
here.
Frank,
here.
Galvez, Gomez,
here.
Hall, McClellan, Montgomery,
here.
Moreno,
here.
Rios,
here.
Salas,
here.
Ward.
Thank you, and I want to start before I ask for a motion for the minutes. I want to welcome the new board members to the first board of MTS. We have five new members, and I just really want to welcome you, and I'm excited to see what all of you bring in the advancement of public transit. So thank you for being here. So with that, if I could please get a motion for the approval of the minutes. Get a second.
Second.
We have a motion. It's been second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moves unanimously. Okay. One abstention. Paul.
So just one educational thing about speaking is that you have to put your mic on. It turns red. So it's the lit up one in the middle with the little squiggle there. And I found the best way to do it is just to look.
Thank you. We have several speakers to address the board on non-agenda. So I'm going to start with John Brady. You will have 5 minutes, and following John will be Martha Welsh.
Good morning. What was my time again?
You have 3 minutes.
3 minutes? Thank you. Good morning, Chairperson Gomez and fellow board members. I wanted to address you this morning, and I appreciate your time. I'm here today representing the voices of our city choir, which is a choir that represents the homeless community here in San Diego and helps them aid in recovery. I'm here with a number of supporters, if you could stand today there or raise your hand. We are here today to address a couple of different issues, but during this moment in time, I wanted to address the access to handicap and reduced fare passes. I wanted to make you aware of the fact that unlike North County and other transit systems, there is a secondary screening place in place here that does not exist anywhere else to my knowledge. So unlike North County, where if a doctor signs it off and says that you are disabled, you qualify for a disabled pass, here there is an individual within the transit system that screens that and denies certain disabilities. I've experienced it. We've had a number of different people experience it, and we question the legality of this, and we're asking you to look into that. Secondly, we're here to request that you extend reduced fare passes to our unsheltered population, who struggle to access transportation to and from the appointments that they need to in order to recover. For those who are simply on food stamps alone, or the few that receive $300 a month, $70 a month is an outrageous amount of their total income to expect them to pay to be able to get around and effect recovery. I want to thank you for your time and hope that you will consider these issues.
Thank you. Martha Welsh, and following Martha will be Stephen Reed.
Martha Welch, MTA is not good to the riders. The trolley, the blue line, and the orange don't meet the orange in San Diego there. It used to be the orange used to go there all the time, and they changed it. And it's very hard for walkers and wheelchair to go over there. It's very hard to do that. The 11 bus was cut in half. Doesn't meet the 12 at all. Now you have to wait for the 901 now on straight right now. Now on Broadway, there's a lack of benches. You know, they don't have benches. They have these hoops instead. And they used to have benches, but now they don't have benches on Broadway right now, just the beginning and the end only. And now 9th Street on Broadway going east. It's off now because they're building something right now, so they can't do that. That's not now. Lack of bathrooms also. You should all, how you do this? Employees to clean them. That's why that's now. Now the old bus 9968 was moved from 24 to 8. Now, I see that bus all the time, and it's empty. It used to be where the 967 was before. Now, it sees two buildings for seniors and a meal place, only once an hour, so that's also me now. Now, the bus pack for seniors used to be 18, now it's going to be 26. That's $8. Now, the driver told me the unit said it'd be 21, so I'm not sure. Now, good news, at least... Now, the receipt tells the date now when you buy your pass. It didn't do it before. Can't tell the lights. It tells you the date. But downstairs, I renewed my pass, but they don't have the new one with pictures anymore. You have the old one, so they don't have the new passes at all downstairs. Now, I just wonder if somebody in MTS says SSD is a bribe because all these things are going on in San Diego. Now, the FBI knows about this. I've been working for months against this all the time. So this is wrong to do with MTS. You change the routes all the time. I think with the 7, because you've had a new bus, because it's not MTS drivers, it's the union seats, a union problem. The other bus doesn't go downtown, so it doesn't have to have union on that other bus that goes farther. So I think that's what you're doing with the 7. Same thing with the 1 that goes farther, with the 215 that goes out there on El Cajon. Same thing, that bus that goes different, that picks it up for differently. It doesn't go downtown, so not union. So I think you're going against the unions.
Stephen Reed. Following Stephen will be Jack Hsu.
Cameron Gomez. Good morning. Good morning. I come to speak to you about a route that I have problems with. There used to be
If I can have staff turn on the mic, or if you don't mind turning on the mic.
Can you hear me?
Yes, it's on.
Okay, one more time. Good morning, everybody. Stephen Reed, the Route 1 bus used to go down to the trolley stop at the foot of 70th Street. I've sent you all a email with a video attached to it, a 1-minute video of myself going down this hill in my wheelchair. I've had people turn away. They don't want to look at it because it scares them, especially on a large screen. Now, if this could be, just look at the video. And decide, this is very dangerous. Also, Elkleton and Hamishaw, the bus stop there has no seats. It's got a one-foot wide strip of gravel, and then it dips down into a trench about 20 feet down. There's no way to climb on board a bus there or to get off a bus there. The bus driver has to stay out in the middle of the street and put the ramp down on the very lip of the concrete in order for anybody to get on or get off there. And for a wheelchair, it's impossible. So you go on to the next stop. That's really about all I have to say, except for the treatment that the officers are providing us on the trolleys. I object strongly to being accused of stealing, because that's exactly what happens every time an officer on the trolley asks to see my bus pass. Now, in major cities across the nation, they solve this problem by putting in turnstiles. Now, obviously, some people are going to jump the turnstiles. I'm not. But I feel very offended whenever I'm asked to produce my bus pass, because I'm just your average individual riding a trolley, and I don't like being accused of stealing, and that's what it amounts to. Thank you for your time.
Jack Hsu, following Jack will be Valerie Hightower.
Good morning. Jack Hsu with Cleveland National Forest Foundation. Happy New Year, and welcome to many of you new to this board. I think this is a chance to put MTS forward and really change our region to be much more forward-thinking and get out of wherever we were in the past. I want to talk to you a bit about security issues we got before us for you today on various fronts. You know, I understand that we have perceived threats that transit places are unsafe places. I also understand the need for us to recover revenues from from people who are using the system. But from my observation, I've seen some good, but I've also seen a lot of bad. I've seen targeting of homeless people, of people who we may categorize as transients. I've seen maybe even internalized oppression, for those of you who study that maybe in diversity or sociology. This isn't very good. It's not the kind of security or law enforcement we need. You know, until transit is effective and competitive with auto traffic, the poor are still going to use the transit system. They're going to be the majority of users. And we should recognize that, and we should serve that. So I have some proposals. Let's try to change the attitude of MTS when it comes to providing security. Let's see it as a public service. Let's not go after fares as the most important issue. Let's see if we could serve people and make transit centers, bus stations, welcoming places where we welcome anybody and provide services for them. Where they're coming from, let's make it like that. Let's train our security staff that, you know, we're going to change your priorities. We want you to be public servants, even though you're private contractors. For code enforcement officers, we understand that. But you're also public servants, and that is the priority. And no matter who they are, whether drug users, transients, we're public servants first. And we make sure that's what's the priority for all the people working for MTS. Thank you.
Good morning, God bless. Y'all act like Southeast is something stuck on the bottom of y'all's shoe. The bus service in Southeast need to be increased, especially the 4 route. Last time I was here, I said the traffic was blocked up 3 blocks long. It wasn't from an accident, it's just Southeast had grown. We need the bus benches put back in the community. We need the 4, the 916, and the 917 increase, along with the 60. We need the bathrooms open that are available. Put a coin box on them. People will pay up to 50 cents to use the bathroom. That'll supply toilet paper, cleaning supplies. Did y'all know Old Town Trolley Station is a doorway for the male prostitute on Crystal? They end up meeting their mates or soliciting other men, and they take them up in Presidio Park and turn tricks. So, and the bus windows, I have mentioned this before, the bus windows that do open, which you kindly have the maintenance, unlock them. It's cold and flu season. You need fresh air. Thank you, and may God bless y'all's decision.
Thank you. So that concludes the public non-agenda comment. We are moving to item number 4, which is the subcommittee that got together to create a slate for various different committees, as well as the nominating of the vice chair and the chair pro temp. We do have a proposed slate that was unanimously supported by the committee. I believe you all have a copy of it. So I want to make a motion to move it forward with an amendment of actually changing the SANDAG board, making Mona Rios the representative on the board, and Nathan Fletcher be the alternate. That would be my only amendment. If I could please get a second, or if there are any questions or comments from boards, and I don't have any public comment requests on this item. We have a second. Please vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moves unanimously.
Congratulations.
Yes, congratulations to everybody. And thank you for stepping up to the plate. Moving on to consent items. We do have various speaker requests on item number 6. So we're going to pull that item. Aside from that, I don't know if there are any other requests. Pull item number 7 as well. Pull item number 6 and number 7. Are there any other requests from board members to pull the items? If I can get a motion to move forward with the consent agenda with the exception of 6 and 7. We have a motion. Second?
Second.
Second by Vice Chair Rios. All those in favor, please say aye. Is there something else?
Number seven is pulled.
Yeah.
It's not just
withdrawn. Oh, withdrawn. Okay, just for the record, number seven is it's withdrawn. So we're not going to be taking that item, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Next month.
We're taking that item next month. I'm learning as we're doing this meeting. So bear with me. So with that, we're going to move forward with item number six. The consent moves forward with the exception of six. So we're going to start with number six. Is there a staff for this item? And item number six is the an amendment to our contract to add security in a new route that is going to be coming alive, South Bay Bus Rapid Transit.
Sharon. Good morning. Staff did not prepare a presentation on this. It's actually kind of pro forma. We have a new BRT that's going to be opening up, and we have a security contract that did not reflect that. So we wanted to add some additional capacity to that security contract so that we could now staff up the South Bay Rapid, which will be opening up at the end of this month. So that's the agenda, and that's the recommendation, is that we increase or amend the contract to add capacity to allow us to have patrols and security on the South Bay Rapid route.
Thank you. So before I call on the board members, I am going to call on the public first and then open it up to the board, okay? So I'm going to start with John Brady, as well as following John would be Stephen Reed.
Good morning, Chairperson Gomez and fellow chair members, our board members. Thank you again for your time. The reason we're here today to address this spending bill is because, again, of the aggressive nature of security on MTS. You know, we spend $39 million a year on security, according to your latest report that Lori Saldana looked at. And that's equivalent to the amount of money that we spend for the Harbor Police. Yet we do not have the same amount of citizen accountability or reporting. So that means that there is no requirement that this private security force report their incidents in any public manner. There's no reporting on how many violations are written versus how many are let go. And the customer service experience on the trolley is completely different from the bus. I want to commend the bus operators. The people that drive the buses are fabulous people. They're really friendly. They're very helpful. They're clearly customer-centric and customer service-oriented. It's a completely different experience at the trolley station. You are not treated fairly. It is an unapproachable group of people wearing badges, and it's very intimidating. The other thing that I wanted to make you aware of is that sometime in the last 2 years, a zero-tolerance policy has been instituted amongst this force. And that means, whereas prior to that date, they were able to have discretion and say, you know what, hey, just get off the trolley, go pay your fare, and catch the next train. Now they're not able to do so. So the number of tickets written on the system went from the hundreds to over 5,000, according to the last report that I looked at. So we ask you to look into this and really seriously look into the customer service experience being provided by your security. Thank you very much.
Stephen Reed. And following Stephen would be Mark Sheets, I believe.
Once again, Chairman Gomez, members of the board, good morning. I can only reiterate what Mr. Brady just said. A private security force untethered can only cause more problems than they solve. I ride the trolleys quite frequently, and I see these people in action, not only on other people, but on myself. They have attitudes to carry on board, and at the end of the day, anything that happens on there that doesn't result in a ticket does not get reported, and there's plenty of it that happens. These guys are abusive, abrasive, and I'm not speaking to every one of them. I wouldn't include all of them in that pile, but for the most part, anytime you ride a trolley, it's not going to be a favorable thing when you're approached by one of the officers. And in linking them to a an accountable security force. I don't care for either one, but I'd much prefer having somebody accountable at the end of the day. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello, Mark Sheets, Chairperson Gomez, and Dick Terry. My complaint about the security is zero tolerance. That's ridiculous. Of these 5,000 plus tickets, I've got probably three. All of them on a Sunday, because I return from work on a Sunday, late Friday. I'm in a warehouse over the weekend. If my bus pass evaporates over the weekend, I don't know it or I don't think about it. And by the time I get back Sunday downtown, I'm tired and I'm not looking so nice. And, you know, so the trolley people, the trolley troopers, I call them, automatically, this kind of person, we don't want him around. Right? Let me see your ticket or your bus pass. Oh, sure, man, no problem. Well, you're on here, you don't have any, it's empty. Oh, I'm sorry, why didn't you check it? Well, the trolley just, I mean, I didn't have time, you know. Wait, here's the ticket. No, I've got $80 on me from work. See, you're taking me off the trolley, and here's the machine. Right here, write me a ticket here. I have $80 from here to here, no problem. I can put $18 in or whatever, but you're going to give me a ticket anyway. I got two tickets in one day. I got off, got the ticket, bought my bus pass, $18, got back on the trolley, two stops later, trolley tripper, no, I didn't buy my ticket because I'm going, I still have my money while I get downtown. Trolley tripper gets on, two stops later. Here's my ticket. Here's another one. Really? Duh!
Marshall Manafi, I believe. The following Marshall would be Ann Barron.
My name is Marshall Menefee, a native San Diegan and a flute player, and I was really tempted to play The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round. My father, who is alive, is 83 years old, and he's retired from the city of San Diego. And my mother was a jazz singer. She was well-traveled, who died 9 years ago on Christmas Day. I want to thank MTS for giving a job to someone I met who was homeless and was a victim of domestic violence. And she's not a victim, but a conqueror. I'm 63 years old, and I believe I look hot because I've never been 63 years old. But let's not assume or react to stereotypes. The security sometimes may see me with a bandana on, several bags, but one's a bag of food, a bag that has my flute and everything, and another bag that probably has clothes. I may appear to be homeless or lost. I walk with a limp. I'm not high or drunk. Sometimes the step to cross the trolley is kind of high. But I know the law is for the lawless. And I just ask that they be compassionate, humane, accountable, and maybe receive some PERT training, which is a psychiatric emergency response team, because the San Diego police have talked me down. They need to have the same type of compassion. But I come to you to say that my father would say they have a job to do that includes rules and regulations. And I just found out that it's a no tolerance. I remember when they would let them off at the next stop, or I have actually given money and say, here's the money, get off at the next stop and pay for your ticket. And I'm sorry I did not address, I guess it is, Mr. Gomez and all the directors, and I sincerely say thank you.
Ann Barron, following Ann would be Ellis Rose.
Good morning. Congratulations to the new members of the MTS board. My name is Ann Barron. I'm with Women Occupy San Diego, and we are working heavily to create a strong citizen oversight of police practices, and now we want to add security guards to that on the MTS. So I ride the mass transit all the time. Profound respect for the bus drivers who deal every day in de-escalation. I am not seeing that in the security guards. So when I'm on the trolley, I have a entirely different experience than many other people. Usually I'm not bothered. I'm hardly ever asked to show a ticket. And oftentimes I'm ignored, which is unlike a lot of other people I've seen in their treatment on the trolley. So I've started taking pictures. I have a camera, and I've been filming a lot of interactions between, and it's hard to tell sometimes if they're security guards. But I've seen security guards hassle young women. Usually it's young women riding their bike onto the trolley station. I do that all the time. I've never been stopped or addressed. They are stopped, they're addressed, and it's kind of an aggressive sexual harassment that these young women are receiving from the security guards. We have credible reports of a young woman wearing hijab having either security guards or MTS police, unclear which one it was, grabbing her hijab off her head after arresting her. And I put arrest in, because we're not quite sure whether she was arrested or not, because there was, it's all very confusing. So this is a great time to break the pro forma contracts that we have with these security agencies. I would ask, actually, we start a conversation on bringing these security, I love security, let's bring them into the public servant and also public employee. Let's stop hiring outside. This gives us more control over their training. They need better training in de-escalation. They just need better training, because to be a security guard, you need very little training. So I do have a couple of questions. What's in the contract that allows MTS to exert greater oversight over the guards that are hired by this outside contractor? And how do I get an answer to that question?
Staff can follow up. This is not a Q&A.
So. Right, so how do I get an answer to
that? Staff will follow up with you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. So again, great time to start a conversation on changing security on the trolley system. Again, huge shout out to the bus drivers. I have seen them de-escalate, and it's been amazing. Thank you.
Following Mr. Rose will be Tasha Williamson.
Chairman Gomez and board members, thank you. I come today partly because a few weeks ago, a friend on Facebook was furious. She had ridden the Green Line and had come in all the way to 12th and Imperial, and I actually don't think I've ever seen it happen anywhere else. And when they got to 12th and Imperial, all the riders on the trolley who hadn't gotten off at other stops before where there was nothing like this were met with approximately 30 security who made everybody get off the trolley and provide proof that they had paid fares. And I am familiar with this because I've been through it in the past too, and it's just not appropriate. It feels every time like a bad scene out of Planet of the Apes where they're corralling all the humans. And I think it's ugly, and I think it's humiliating. I lived in Chicago for 8 years, and I never had a car. And I used public transportation all the time, and I used their L system. And we never had that. And why didn't we have that? We had that because if you wanted to prove that you paid, you knew it, because people had to go through the turnstile that somebody else mentioned earlier, and there was no checking on the train to see if you paid your fare. When I worked for a hotel, I had to warn my guests, please do not try and challenge the trolley system. Don't try and hop the trolley. Because if you get a ticket, it's expensive, and it is. And I think that the system, the trolley transit system, has set up a system that encourages and tempts people, especially poor people or homeless people who cannot afford to do otherwise, but need to get to 12th and Imperial, because this is where public aid and food stamps, et cetera, are found. It tempts them to get on here when they feel they have no other resource and they have to risk that chance of a ticket. This is increasing the criminalization of poverty and of homelessness. And I can't urge you enough that you really have to look at your system and you have to look at a different security procedure than just simply this so-called honor system. We do have concerns about the fact that we know that there is a lawsuit for men alleging abuse and excessive force from security, and we know that costs the system money, and that the system wastes money on that instead of spending it on public transportation. We feel that customer service approach is very, very much badly needed. Security needs to be trained in proper trained de-escalation in terms of proper use of force and being trained in related issues such as physical disabilities, mental health issues, and related issues such as homelessness. I can't tell you the number of times I've seen homeless people who have been on the train and they've been on the train because, or the trolley because they need to get there.
In one last sentence, please.
So, thank you. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you. Ms. Williamson.
Thank you. I come to you today because MTS has lost millions of dollars over the decades in lawsuits. I look back at when Martin Luther King boycotted the bus, and we will be launching a boycott of MTS. There is no way possible that in 2019 and 2018, poor people have been accepted in the brutalization by security guards all over this MTS trolley stops, and it will no longer be acceptable. So what we will be doing is launching a boycott because you refuse to do something about your rogue and lawless security guards who want to portray that they are officers. They are unbecoming of officers. They are unbecoming of security guards. I have witnessed video after video after video, which is considered evidence in court and should be evidence to MTS and this board or committee, that there is something inherently wrong with your security system. And because you do nothing, then we will act. There are white allies that want to know what to do, and we are asking you, just as they did in the 1960s, to use your vehicles to transport people to their destinations, to cost MTS so much money that they have nothing more to do than to stop the brutalization of poor people. If it continues, we will make it so that you lose so much money, you have to fire employees, starting with security guards. It is time's up. It is done. There is no more talking. When we don't see anyone representing us, we need to stand up, and we will. I see politicians here that have not stood up in National City, that have not stood up in San Diego, that have not stood up in the Board of Supervisors. And Nathan, you're new, but the Board of Supervisors has not stood up. And so when you don't have a politician that represents you, you become one. Today, I will be putting my name on the ballot for mayor for 2020 because I am tired of the way the city of San Diego and the county of San Diego runs itself with poor people, people with mental health issues, people who are of diverse cultures. It is time up. We are tired. So we, the people, will take this city back, we will take this county back, and we will destroy MTS if you don't stop the brutalization of our people. Thank you.
Thank you, and that concludes the public for this item. I'm going to start with council members with questions. Mr. Ward.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and I want to thank members of the public for bringing this item up and the conversation that needs to happen. I appreciate that it got pulled. I was intending to pull it as well, too. It's my understanding from this contract that we're asking for an amendment of over $900,000, and that would bring the total for this contract to over $39 million.
I'm not sure the exact figure, but it's certainly in that neighborhood, yes.
Thank
you. Over a 5-year period.
Thank you. So I certainly understand the need to be able to provide security services, reasonable security services at the expanded trolley stations, the BRT stations. I have, I think, overriding concern from escalating news and observation. I know this is my first official meeting as a sitting board member, but for a council member representing the downtown communities, many reports that have come to me in my office, and then also as the chair of the Regional Task Force on the Homeless, really a strong concern for how we're using our public investments in the name of security, but more responsibly, I think, in a way to try and engage the public. I did send a letter to MTS last year wearing my council member hat as one of several issues I hope to partner between the city and MTS on. I'm really pleased to be on the board to make more progress in this space. And so for that reason, I'm not going to be in a position to be able to support this. I hope that a reallocation of some of the existing funds under this contract might be able to satisfy some of the security needs. Working on street outreach, if we have these funds available, I think that they are better spent in a more hybrid of approach. And I know that this is going to require a much broader policy level conversation. I'm looking forward to that. Sort of as an important aside too, I'm also concerned with the need that we have for a robust security system, but one that I think if this is a core public service to integrate with this public agency, that we need to think about for reasons of transparency and accountability, having an expanded service that is actually a part of MTS as well. But for the formerly stated reasons, I won't be able to support this item today.
Councilmember Montgomery.
Thank you to the public for coming out to speak on this item. And also thank you to staff for during the executive committee, bringing it out and answering questions that I had last week about this. I would, though, just procedurally, I'll start with some of the procedural requests first, that I foresee that this will be a hot topic in the next years as we figure it out. So it might behoove us to put it on, take it out of consent agenda so that we can make time for these discussions. And also include some of the backup material, which would be the contracts. I think that would help us prepare a bit better and help the public get the idea of what is actually in these contracts. I know it's long, but I think that is necessary. So for procedurally, I hope that staff will consider that and the chair will consider that. Additionally, this is something that I reiterated at the city, that we do see stark differences, or we hear stark differences between what the public is telling us, what we see on the videos, and what our staff is saying, and that is a major issue that needs to be rectified. I don't believe that there is a proper structure for accountability. I don't think that reviewing of these videos and making a decision from a staff-only level will take us through to where we need to be. And so as a member of the Public Security Committee at MTS, I do want to take that up and look at that as an item as well. Training is another major issue, depending on how hopefully we can restructure this to where all riders feel safe and don't feel intimidated, and at the same time we can get the security that we need. Again, we are not putting down every single person that is providing security on these trolley lines, but there is clearly a problem and it needs to be addressed. And so procedurally, I would just like to ask those questions of staff, but also acknowledge that I have seen these videos previous to getting to this board, and this is the main reason why I'm serving on that Public Security Committee, so that we can address these concerns. So I just want to reiterate that with regard to this item. Now, I do understand this item as being an amendment to a contract that is already out there for, you know, the amount of $38 million before we do this. So it's not the type of structural change that I'm looking for. I honestly don't know that a vote no would matter as much today, but I do want the public to know that I am committed to this issue. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Montgomery. Mayor Salas?
Yes. So I'd like to ask our Director of Security a couple of questions relative to the kind of oversight that we have, that MTS has over these contractors that we have that are providing the security services. Is there any oversight that we have to the quality of that and the report? This is a little bit troubling to me that I'm coming to this meeting and I hear so many members of the public, reporting incidences of rudeness and maltreatment to the writing public. Do you get those reports and how do they come to us?
Right. First of all, we do have oversight. Ultimately, I'm responsible for the security contract as well as our co-compliance inspectors. We also, the security contractors have an on-site manager, and they also have two mid-managers, and then they have about 12 or 13 frontline supervisors. So anytime there's an incident, it gets documented on into our database, for one. And I also receive an incident report from supervisors on every incident that occurs. Anytime there's a use of force, and we count everything as a use of force if someone's being handcuffed. Unlike law enforcement, we do that because we want an opportunity to make sure it gets documented and that we get a chance to review it. So anytime there's a use of force documented, we also document on a use of force form. We review every video, all the video that's available to us, including something occurs on a trolley, we review the trolley video, we review station video, and we also review body camera video, which all of our co-compliance inspectors and security officers wear. I've seen some of that video on YouTube and a few other things. There's some of it that does not look good, and there are some that don't look good, but you don't get the full picture because the entire video isn't on YouTube. But we review them. If there's misconduct, then we take appropriate action. And I will tell you, the action that we've taken on majority of use of force incidents that were inappropriate were self-initiated by us. My staff and I, there's a deputy director and our field operations manager, we review those videos. There are people who are no longer working here for improper use of force. But at times, and the majority of the time, the use of force is proper and it falls in with the legal guidelines.
But with all due respect, I'm not talking about when it rises to the level of use of force. I'm talking about the general courtesy and respect of and dignity of people that are riding the trolley.
Right. We provide, first of all of our security guards and our co-compliance inspectors go through training. For our co-compliance inspectors, we, on an annual basis, we provide de-escalation training. We've recently, someone mentioned PERT. We had the PERT director come and teach a PERT class to our staff last year. De-escalation training is an annual training that we are doing now. We teach defensive tactics. Everybody's been through the laws of arrest class. We don't tolerate discourtesy when it comes to our attention. We'll take a look at it and address it if it's inappropriate. And nothing. We don't sweep anything under the carpet.
Okay. And how high is the turnover? How high is the turnover of the security staff?
The contract security staff, the turnover is extremely high.
Right.
It's extremely high. Co-compliance inspectors is very reasonable. We recently, as you know, we added 30 co-compliance inspectors in 2017. I would say it's less than 10%, well, about 10% a year. A lot of times we get people that are applying for law enforcement jobs. This is kind of the stepping stone for them. We've had let a few people go. A few people determine this is just really not the work for them. But it's, I would think, comparable to a law enforcement agency.
So I think that the turnover rate is also problematic because you're having to continually be training people. And they may not, so I don't know if there's a better way that security guards are, first of all, screened for the positions that they are taking, but obviously something has to, some improvement has to happen in whatever we're doing.
This security contract is extremely challenging for us. The pay for security guards on our system is a little bit lower than other job sites. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge to keep our staff up to staff. But they still go through all the training, 240 mm-hmm. hours for security guards, on top of whatever security guard training they had just mm-hmm. to come to this site.
So, you know, we better look at the wage scale, too, because that's part of the turnover problem, and do an assessment whether, you know, the continual hiring, because that is costly when you have to go through the hiring process, the training process, and if you're having retention problems, I think you have to really take a look at that as well. So I'm really glad that the item was pulled for a discussion on some of the problems that we're having that maybe the board was not aware of, but that... being said, I would like to continue the discussion as and happy to work with Ms. Montgomery on this issue to make sure that, you know, we have the best quality possible security guards and that they're treating all humans with dignity. But having said that, we have problems in the way that we're doing things, we still need security. And so for that reason, and understanding the importance of the bus rapid transit system that's coming on and the need for new personnel, I will be supporting the motion today, but with the understanding that we have a lot of work to do on this issue.
Thank you, Mayor Salas. And just, is that a motion?
A motion.
Thank you. We have a motion. Thank you, Vice Chair Mona. Supervisor Fletcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're all in agreement that we want the folks who use our transit system to feel safe. It is concerning when folks come before us and say that they don't feel safe from the people that are supposed to keep them safe. And I think that those are concerns we all have to take to heart in making sure we have a system where the folks that are providing safety are doing it in a way to ensure that those on transit feel safe. But I have a couple questions. One of them, I have this bus system we're expanding it to, is that currently operating, or what is the date that'll start?
It starts at Sunday the 27th of January. It's an actual Transnet route, and it's the security is going to be funded by Transnet. It's been planned and constructed by Sandag.
So if this item isn't approved, then when that bus line opens, there would be no security at all?
Well, what we would have to do is try to stretch security from somewhere else.
Okay, but you could
or not,
because I think what a lot of us are getting at is that there's concerns about the overall way that we approach how we handle these issues when it comes to security, and I think this is a good time to have that discussion and really, especially with a lot of us that are new that may have new questions as we get up to speed. I mean, one question I have, you know, obviously if you have a security person who's protecting an empty building in an industrial area, then traditional security training is would seem adequate. In this instance, where you have individuals who come encounter with folks who have higher percentages, perhaps of being affected by homelessness or being unsheltered or perhaps mental health, is there any PERT type training or mental health specific training that our officers receive that is different from kind of standard security guard services?
Yeah, our co-compliance inspectors do receive that training. It's up to the security contractors to provide their training. They have a certain mandated training. That's not one of the mandated, but recommended.
So, like, that's something I think that we should probably explore as a board. You know, is that the type of training and the mindset that they come into this with? When it comes to oversight, and I understand that they're private security and it's different, but they still are performing essentially a law enforcement function. Is there anything comparable to the oversight type boards or citizens review boards that we see with police departments or sheriff's departments as it applies to the MTS law enforcement service?
No.
Okay. I have some broader concerns just about structurally how we approach this issue. And I think when all of us have a desire and a drive to have more people take transit, it's just vitally important that we have the public confidence and faith that we've put in place a system that really ensures their safety and protection. And so I think as a board, this is an issue that I certainly share a number of my colleagues' desire to have some more substantive discussions on how we structure this, how we properly fund it, how we properly ensure that there's training and oversight. And those are issues I think it's incumbent upon this board, especially with something that's not an insignificant dollar amount and also not an insignificant impact on those who use the services, that we should certainly review. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul?
I was just going to say, I want to reiterate what Manny said. All of our code compliance received this de-escalation sensitivity training. And the way our deployment is that we put the private security with a code enforcement. They act as teams, and they're the ones out there. So there very often is somebody who's had the training. But notwithstanding that, with the slate that we just passed, we have a new safety and security committee. And I would suggest that we schedule one relatively soon, mm-hmm. and we have this discussion within that committee.
What is the percentage of the officers who have that training versus the total security workforce?
About 60 out of 200. But okay. When I say that, when it's 200 total, a lot of those are supervisors, et cetera. So it's probably about 60 and 120, so 2-to-1.
Right. I would certainly support having our public safety thing have a standalone meeting specifically on this, to walk through the contracts. I would also be curious at that meeting if we could compare MTS practices versus other urban transit systems and how they deal with these issues and the systems and things that they have in place. You know, I suspect these issues are not unique to us, but there could be things that we do. You know, there could be best practices we could learn from. So.
Yes, so I too want to thank the public for being here. I'm happy that we have moved the slate of the new committee members. We do have a new makeup of the Public Security Committee that I'm hoping that this discussion related to how we're relating with the public through security is something that we're looking at updating. There was mention of pay, there's mention of training and all of that. I've already directed my staff to work with MTS staff to pull all the policies that we currently have related to this topic, so when the committee does meet, this is something that is also getting reviewed. We're updating, and just overall, I know that the overall contract that is being referred to will be reissued soon. This is just an extension for the coverage of the South Bay, but we're actually going to be putting out that new RFP in the next couple of, either this year or next year, depending on the timeline, but it's coming up soon.
Yeah, the contract expires in July of 21, so the procurement would start the year prior.
Okay.
2020.
Okay, so that's something that the committee should be looking at, just in terms of what should go out, so this is something that is definitely should be a priority of the board, and I'm hoping that these discussions occur at the committee level to bring something forward for action in the near future. So I really appreciate the public for being here, and definitely there's no question whatsoever that making sure that we're being transparent, that we're creating a safe and better approachable way in which people are riding our transit is important for the riders. We're here to ensure that we have a safe system, that we have an efficient and speedy system, and there's a lot of work to do. Not only just security overall, there's a lot of work to do that we need to do to improve our transit. That's why I express what I said earlier. I am very happy to have the new board members. I think there's going to be a lot of progression in terms of where we are now and where we're going to be going with transit overall. So, Ms. Montgomery, do you have anything?
Just real quick, I also understand the need of security. This is, again, like I said, this has been going on for a long time, so this is an amendment to what has already been going on. But I don't want to wait until we are developing another RFP to look at what is in the current contract, even with regard to courtesy issues. I want to ensure that we can revisit this, if I were to support this today, to ensure security that we could revisit this in the next month or two, because I don't want to send a message to the public that it's okay for folks to be treated like this for the next 2 years while we're figuring out process stuff. So, right.
No, for sure. I mean, there are checks and balances that we currently have that need to be updated. So just so you know, for the board members before, I mean, there were some incidences that I got reported to directly. So I did some follow-ups with staff. There was an outcome that occurred from that. So we have the power as board members to, if we have direct access to some complaints, to do follow-ups. So we definitely there are things that we can do as board in terms of updating our policies on how our current contract should be managed. There's accountability to be had, and there's policies that we should be dusting off and updating them now.
I would just add, if any board member wants to do a ride along in the next, before we address it with either the public security committee or back to the board, more than welcome. We'll coordinate that.
All right. So with that, we do have a motion. It's been second. Please vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We have three. So we have seven. How many do we have? Okay. Yeah. Three. Thank you all. So moving forward with we're going to hold closed session at the end. So we're going to move forward with the agenda items, and then once we're done, we're going to go into closed session. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to item 30, the San Diego Transit Cooperative Pension Investment Status.
Thank you and good morning. Today we are going to talk through the investment results and the actuarial valuation of the San Diego Transit Pension Plan. And this pension plan is for bus drivers and maintenance folks for the San Diego Transit Pension Plan. It is a closed plan, so there are no new non-management employees that are going into the plan. So it is a closed plan. All new employees that are hired go into a defined contribution plan, a 401k style plan. And so with that, we have Jeremy Miller from RVK, who will present an item 30, the investment results ending June 30th of 2018. And then item 31, we have Alice Ellsberg and Ann Harper from Chiron, who will be reporting the actuarial results based upon fiscal year end of 2018 as well. So item 30, I'll turn it over to Jeremy and he'll talk through the investment return.
Thank you, Larry. Hello, everyone. We have the slides up on the screens. I will go ahead and get started on slide one, which we look at the investment structure. All of the slides we'll be looking at will be as of fiscal year end, 6/30/2018. At the top of slide one, you can see the asset allocation as it sits at the end of the fiscal year relative to target. So we have each of the asset classes, four broad asset classes listed there: domestic equity, so U.S. stocks, international equity, so international stocks, fixed income, which is bonds, and multi-asset portfolios that include these assets as well as other opportunistic holdings. You can see the market values, the percentages, and it relative to the current target, and you can see the variances are small, so your current holdings at the end of the fiscal year were quite close to target. This is a well-diversified plan across those asset classes that seeks to maximize return, but of course we do so relative to liabilities. So liability aware, we're trying to take prudent levels of risk. And so when we structure our assets, we structure them with our liabilities in mind. And one of those items that will come up during the actuarial presentation is the closed nature of the plan. So this plan tends to be more diversified, so a little less risky, think less equities, and more liquid, so we do not hold any private structures. So we have a balanced, conservative portfolio that's broadly diversified, and as we can see at the bottom, while we can't control markets, we can control costs. So we have made efforts there to try and reduce those. On slide 2, we get into the investment details. The bolded items you can see are the same asset classes from the previous slide. We also have the details listed here with the various investment strategies or managers, starting with Westwood all the way down to PAMCO Pacific Hedge. So your portfolio is well diversified across 12 different products. This helps to increase diversification with the portfolio, which reduces the risk, including concentration risk within any particular holding. On slide 3, we look at performance. This is, as you can see, fiscal year, you began with $162.1 million. You had a net outflow for benefit payments of about $5 million, an investment gain of about $9.7 million, which brings you to fiscal year end, $166.8 million. And a return just shy of 6%. Your actuarial assumed rate is 7%, so you are slightly below your actuarial rate. Last year, you were about the same amount above that rate, so it fluctuates year to year. The return is largely a reflection of where markets went. While we did see tech and some growth stocks do particularly well and grab headlines, other stocks within the U.S. Did not do as well. U.S. value stocks were up about 6%. International stocks were also up about 6%. Bonds were actually negative, down about 0.5%. And REITs were up about 2%. That's real estate investment trusts. So it's largely a reflection of where markets were for fiscal year 2018. On slide 4, we get into some of the performance details. So we take that number in the top green line, the 5.98 from the previous page, and then we break it down as we go down that column. You can see your domestic equities, so U.S. stocks were up 12.5%. Your international stocks were up 9.25%. But as I mentioned, the bond market as a whole was down about 0.5%, negative 0.5%. So you're not surprising that your bonds were down slightly, 21 basis points, and alternatives were up about 2.4. So while we did slightly underperform for the year relative to your actuarial assumed rate, we do think the portfolio is positioned well going forward with a diversified, liquid, and conservatively allocated structure. That concludes RVK's comments. Happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you for the presentation. We do have one request from the public to speak on this item. Ms. Williamson.
Yes, while I was sitting here, people were chiming in on Facebook Live, talking about the amount of money that they spend, $72 a month for a bus pass. As I hear the money that is going into retirement, that is all great. In 90 days, we have decided that we will boycott MTS. Your retirement money will be substantial. Because until you fire this security team, you will not have any money coming in from the public. So it would behoove you to think about retirement plans, to think about your staff, to think about the public at large who help you to have $15 million with interest and everything for retirement plans. It would behoove you to take serious how the public is being treated, because if you multiply $72 by the amount of people that you have riding the public transportation on your MTS, it's going to hurt you. We plan to hurt MTS as they have allowed their security teams to brutalize poor people.
poor people who are paying $72 a month, poor people who are being brutalized over not having a $2.50 ticket, poor people who have not been able to purchase a $5 day pass. These are people that have been helping build your company, and we will stop it.
Thank you. Are there any comments? Yes, Mr. McLean.
Yes, I notice over the last 1, 3, 5, and 10 years, we've never hit that 7% mark. I just wonder, are we going to be underfunding this in the future the way we have been in the past years, or should we put a little more money into this to where we can take care of this deficit?
That's a great question. And in our next presentation, we will be presenting kind of the plan. Since it is a closed plan, we have a plan in place since, you know, for the past several years of how we pay off a lot of the amortized actuarial liability to ultimately get to a normal cost where those contributions will decrease significantly in the coming years.
But we're predicting 7%, and we haven't hit that in, if I'm reading this right, in the last 10 years.
Well, we've hit it on an annual basis. There have been years that we have. When you blend it over 3 and 5 years, the average has not hit 7%.
Yeah.
But we are, again, we're looking at all those different options. We're continuing to look at investment managers and their performance. We're also looking at the actuarial assumed rate of return, which we'll be exploring through the next experience study to determine whether or not that rate should be reduced. So we are looking at all that.
And, you know, over 10 years, it says 4.68. Is that the average for the 10 years?
Correct.
Well, that's way under the 7% that we're predicting. So we need to build that up to where we, when our people are retired and retiring.
Yes. And we actually reduced that rate. It was 7.5%.
I remember.
That was reduced to 7%, I want to say 2 years ago, three years ago?
Yes, 3 years ago.
I remember.
2016, yeah.
And I don't think that was enough. I think we need to reduce it down some more.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions from the board? Council Member Moreno.
Thank you for the presentation. How does our plan performance compare to the performance of major index funds? As an example, how does it compare to SDSUR's performance or CalPERS?
So relative to other indexes, I did include some of those items in my comments. Relative to other plans within California, we were in the neighborhood, but we were slightly less. We do have less risk in the portfolio, so less in stocks. We also don't hold private assets as a closed plan. We don't want to have assets that could potentially be gated or have less liquidity when you have more payments to retirees. So those factors, when you factor in asset allocation, that largely explains the difference in performance. So we were about plus about 6, they were plus about 8. So that's roughly the difference.
So we're slightly under.
We have not performed to the same level as they have. The one caveat to that is we have about $160 million of assets. Many of these are in the billions. And so they can afford the ability, and our plan is closed. They still have active plans. So they have the luxury of more time to withstand market fluctuations where ours necessarily, we don't necessarily have that time. And so we don't invest in higher risk type transactions mm-hmm. based upon the market size of our portfolio and the duration of time. So,
and thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And to staff, when did we close our pensions for?
That was 2012.
2012, okay, thank you.
We actually have three different pensions. The one we're talking about here is for San Diego Transit, the bus drivers, and the maintenance workers on the bus side. And that was converted from a defined benefit pension plan to a defined contribution plan in 2012. And so the other parts of the organization, San Diego Trolley, has one PERS pension plan. I should also say that San Diego Transit also pays Social Security. San Diego Trolley does not pay Social Security. They have a PERS plan, and MTS has a PERS plan and pays Social Security. So it's three different legacy pension plans from when everything was separate, and then we combined it into MTS. But there's really no way around that. We have to keep those legacy systems.
Are there any other questions? Councilmember Ward.
Thank you, Chair. And I wanted to just further underscore as well, too, some of my concern for some of the assumptions that are here based on our own past performance. You're still projecting over the next 3, 5, 10 years a 5% annual growth is my read from some of your projections.
No, the items we have in here are historical in nature only. We do look at forward-looking projections for assets on an annual basis, and we work with the investment committee to look at those. When it comes to setting the actuarial rate, though, that is something that the investment consultant would provide information to the actuary, but that is something that the actuary makes the determination on what that forward-looking projection would be.
Does the actuary, do you have any comment about forward-looking projections?
I guess I'll also just add that our forward-looking projections are more, probably a little bit shorter run in nature as we're trying to take advantage of where markets might be. Our return assumptions have been coming down over time, and that has been influencing what the actuaries have been doing with their assumptions as well. But when they look at their assumptions, we're one data point. They're going to try and look at multiple data points when they come up with their assumption. But yes, our assumptions have been coming down. They are in the neighborhood of that 6 to 7 range is where we're predicting going forward.
Right.
So our process is that we do perform an experience study every 5 years. And with that study, we do look at the economic assumptions that we're using to project assets for the plan. And what we do is we take the capital market assumptions that Jeremy and RVK provide to us with and apply them to the asset classes that are in your portfolio to come up with an expected rate of return for the portfolio. And we look at that and compare it to where the investment return is currently, and with staff and the executive committee's recommendations, we decide on a reasonable rate. So back in 2016, we did lower the investment assumption return from 7.5 to 7, which was a relatively large jump. Most plans go down by 0.25%.
No, we've had to do the same. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to be mindful of the board's time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I heard you answer that as well for our colleague over here, too. We've done the same, of course, at the City of San Diego. But still, based on even past performance, I know we've had some good years in 2016, 2017, we're above the 7%.
Right.
But on the whole, you can't really point to a five-year period looking back that you even exceeded 5 to 6% that you even came close to hitting a 7%. And all this is going to lead into is the next item, for example, that we're going to have to continue to be able to actually adopt more findings that place more of the burden on some of the participants because we're not meeting these kind of turns. I guess the last thing, because this is just for information only, is that I am highly suspicious. I know that you all are the experts in the field, and you're definitely in the weeds and monitoring. But for somebody that is trying to kind of also monitor what's going on with market forces and trying to see things from the 30,000 foot level, I'm very nervous about any sort of positive returns for the next 2 years. And I appreciate that you mentioned, I heard the word conservative used earlier as far as where our asset allocation is currently put. I think that's very wise, but we're going to be continuing to rely on you for that expertise, I think, in a way that hopefully continues to place us in a conservative direction. I just I'm not seeing any positive indicators out there right now that give us the information that I would need as a board member to say, I think it would be smart to do a moderate or a slightly aggressive portfolio. I hope that we are being mindful of this because it's only going to continue to hurt the participants, you know, in a 5 to 10 year time frame if we're not smart about what's going on around us for the next 3 years. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Any other? Yes, Councilmember Galvez.
Thank you. I echo the previous comments about the expected rate of return and the lowering from 7.5 to 7 was significant, but I think it's worthy of actually maybe even making a more substantial lowering consideration, maybe to 6.5 or 6. And what would it take to do that?
So we do an actuarial experience study every 5 years. We could take a look at that and potentially look at that a little bit earlier than, you know, in 2 years, so we can get that started and look at potentially doing an experience study a little bit earlier, just to take a look at the markets and what the market forecasts would be and what the impacts that would be on our plan and what the additional contributions would be necessary in order to accommodate that. The one thing you'll see in the next presentation, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but you will see a plan. Like, again, back in 2012, we closed this plan, and we have even given a 7% rate of return, or even if it's lower, there is a plan for it to get down to a normal cost, where your contributions are going to go from $15 million down to about $1 to $1.5 million. So we will get to that in item 31, but we absolutely can take a look at that actuarial experience study and get that rolling and start putting in the assumptions and seeing what the contribution effect would be if we were to go in that direction.
I think that would be very valuable and appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other board members, so this is just informational item, no need for a motion. So before I call on the next item, I actually made a mistake, and we do have a request to address the board on the closed session item, so I'm going to go back and then continue the conversation on this. So with that, Mr. Padilla, and you've been time seated, so you'll have 5 minutes.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, and thank you, Madam Chair, for the courtesy. I know you have some heavy items ahead. Steve Padilla, on behalf of Grand Central West LLC, I have appeared before this board, unfortunately, on a number of occasions on the matter of the MTS property that's located immediately behind and adjacent to the McDonald's trolley station building at the San Ysidro Land Port of Entry, which, not coincidentally, is one of the busiest land ports in the world and also your busiest transit station in the MTS network, and also serves a number of transit-dependent and riders that cross the international border that contribute to our binational economy and that are largely from underserved communities in the border region. For a number of years, and I want to also welcome and congratulate the new board members. I think the new composition, both of the leadership and the board, is beyond refreshing. And I am hoping that you will hear us again as I've come before you many, many times on this issue. For a number of years, this agency has pursued a policy with respect to that property, which is a public property, a public asset that was acquired by this agency with public funds for a public purpose, and has sought to treat that land as private property. You have pursued a policy that has resulted in damages not only to the adjoining long-term property owner, Grand Central West, but most important of all, without explanation, the agency pursued a policy that did nothing but damage and even exposed to additional, in my opinion, liability of this agency, the City of San Diego, to put at risk the safety of the traveling public, particularly people with disabilities, particularly people who are laden with luggage, particularly people who are trying to directly access a connection between your fixed rail station and the bus platform. The property in question, again, was acquired with public funds for a public purpose to provide a public space for a bus platform to connect travelers from many different modes of travel to private intercity bus connections. Incidentally, this body has then also pursued litigation against Grand Central West for the past 4 years, expending large sums of public dollars, again in a pursuit of a policy that didn't seem to have an explanation and didn't seem to have any other impact than to simply seek to treat that public property as though it were private property. That property has been and continues to be accessible to just about everyone, unless they access it from the McDonald's building. This is what we call a selective trespass claim, which you can't do. Fast forward to the 24th of December of last year. After expending millions on this property that is, to this day, has not provided any return to this agency and has not provided any benefit but damage to the local community, The trial court, in your litigation, rendered its decision against MTS and in favor of Grand Central West. No doubt in closed session, you may be advised by your counsel that this is not settled, that it's a tentative decision. Perhaps, I hope, it will be explained to you what the rules of the court process are with respect to the statement of decision. The court's decision is final. The option the agency has is to appeal that. I hope that this agency will consider not throwing more public funds, more good money after bad, to pursue, again, a policy that is inexplicable, that is not benefiting your transit riders, your constituents, in one of your most underserved communities in the entire system and in the entire region. I should point out that it also goes contrary, goes completely contrary to your own planning policies. It goes contrary to your own transit-oriented development policies, and it harms your own constituents. Millions have been spent dealing with this parcel, and after 4 years and after a trial, here we are, a judgment that will be entered against MTS. This is not private property. This is a public asset. It should be utilized to benefit the public. This has gone on long enough. The money that has been expended on this litigation by this agency could have well been used to benefit the transit riding public, particularly those in this underserved community. It still, after my own involvement in this case for more than 4 years, it defies logic and explanation, A, what the policy is, why it's been pursued, and why it continues. Madam Chair, members of this board, it is time to bring an end to this ridiculous fiasco. And respectfully, it is time to start asking the question with respect to the management of this issue for the last 4 years, who is responsible for this mess? I urge you to exercise leadership and oversight, which in my respectful, humble opinion has been missing, over your executive team, and bring an end to the waste of public assets and the damage that this is doing to the community. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So with that, we're going to move back to the discussion items. Item 31, the San Diego Transit Cooperation Employment Retirement Plan. Turn it over back to staff.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. I'm Ann Harper, and this is Alice Alsberg with Chiron. And we are here to report the results of the July 1st, 2018 actual evaluation. To give you a little bit of background on what this valuation is, we do this every year to evaluate the plan's funding status and determine if there are any contribution adjustments that are necessary. We take a snapshot look at the plan's membership as of June 30th, 2018. We look at the active members, their salaries, and project what the retirement benefits are going to be, when they're going to retire. And then we also look at the retirees and what their benefits currently are, and make assumptions about how long those benefits are going to be paid. So with that, that's the total plan liability, both actives and the retirees and some inactives. And when we look at that snapshot, we only calculate what benefits have accrued today, and we compare them to the current assets as of June 30th, 2018. And we ask the question, did these liabilities and assets grow as we had expected them to? And if not, then we need to make some adjustments to the contribution to keep the plan on target. Then we're also going to look at some plan history just for context, and most importantly, we're going to look at some projections of the contributions and funded status based on all of our actuarial assumptions and the plan's funding policy. So based on our valuation, the contributions for the 2018 valuation are $15.9 million. That's just a slight increase from last year's valuation, where the contribution was 15.6, and that's just under a 2% increase, which is in line with cost of living adjustment. There are two offsetting factors that change the contribution. The first is that the assets did not meet its benchmark this year. They earned less than a little less than 6%, and we're expecting them to earn 7%. So with that, the contribution rate is, or the contribution is increasing by about $500,000.
And then the other offsetting factors is that there is a declining active population because all new drivers and mechanics are going into a 401k plan. So members are retiring or maybe they're leaving the system. So there are less active members, and with that there are less benefits than accruing in the pension plan. This year there were about 50 less active members at about 460 active members. The contribution is divided into three pieces. We have the normal cost rate, or the normal cost, and that is the cost that active members' benefits are accruing for the current year. So you're immediately paying for all benefits that are accruing in the current year for those active members. Then the bigger piece of that contribution is your UAL payment. That's the unfunded accrued liability. And an unfunded will arise. An unfunded accrued liability arises when you're not meeting your target, meaning the actual assumptions, or if that target changes, if you change the actual assumptions, you can have then changes in the unfunded accrued liability. Currently, the total unfunded liability is $125 million, so that $12.1 million payment is to cover that unfunded, and the funding policy in place currently is that that unfunded will be paid off in 2037, and so that UAL payment will go to zero. And you're going to also see that sliver of the normal cost decreasing as more members are leaving the system, active members. And when I say leaving, I mean retiring and not accruing additional benefits. This shows the contribution history. Back in 2009, the contribution was $7.7 million, and that's increased to $15.9 million. This pattern that you're seeing here is very consistent with a lot of the California plans that we work on and also with systems nationwide. And the reason is that in 2008, there was a huge market crash, and so all systems were impacted by that. So you're seeing the contributions increasing, that requirement is increasing because you're needing to put more money into the plan to make up for those investment losses. And also, we have continued to lower the assumed investment rate of return. It was 8% back at the beginning of 2009. So some of those spikes are also when we made assumption changes. For instance, in 2016, you can see that jump from 12 million to 15.1. That was mostly a result of the investment assumption return. And actually, members also are anticipated to be living longer. So what that means is you're paying benefits for a longer period of time. So you have to adjust your target to make more contributions. Here we're showing you the funded status of the plan. The total bars, the yellow plus the gray bars combined, are the actuarial accrued liability. The gold bars are your assets, and the gray bar is the unfunded liability for those years. You can see that the liabilities in 2009 were about $200 million, and they've increased to about $300 million in 2018, while the assets have also increased, but just not as fast. So you're seeing that there has been a decline in your funded ratio. Just to highlight a couple things, in 2014 and 15, you can see that the funded ratio was increasing, and that is due to your asset performance in those years. And then the dip in 2016, again, due to the assumption changes that we made as a result of the experience study. So the funded ratio has stayed stable at about 58%. And so what that means is for every dollar of liability, the accrued liability that the plan has, you have 58 cents in assets to cover those at this point. And this is just a little history about your membership of the plan. The membership has declined, the total membership has declined from about 1,800 employees to about 1,660 employees. And mostly due to the fact that it is a closed plan. So you're not seeing any new entrants coming in as of 2012. And so the active membership is represented by the gold bars, and the retirees are represented by the blue bars. And the small sliver of gray bar is just members who have actually left employment, but they left employment with a vested benefit, but yet aren't able to retire yet because they're not eligible. And again, these are just headcounts of the plan's membership. This slide is just showing you kind of the transition of membership as a percentage of the total. So you can just see the shift of percentage of the retirees from 40 to about 60% in that 10-year period. Actives decreased from about 46 to 28%, and the same trend and pattern can be seen in the plan's liabilities, where currently 65% of the liabilities is due to the retirement or the retirees that are currently receiving benefits. And that's a higher percentage than we see, slightly higher than we see nationwide, but it's makes sense because the plan is closed. And that's also the reason why there's a more conservative approach to the asset allocation, because you have so much of your liability for the retirees. And with that, I will let Alice talk about the projections.
Thank you. So at this point, we understand that the results of the current valuation have determined the contribution for the coming fiscal year to be $15.9 million, and the funded status of the plan is 58%. The next two charts that we have coming up will show us projections of these two measures. But it's important, before we take a look at the projections, to understand that projections are estimates based on the current assumptions of the plan. And should actual experience deviate from these assumptions, the projections would then be modified as well. Here we see a graph of the total future contributions for the next 30 years in the plan. In 2018, as discussed, the contribution for the coming fiscal year was determined to be $15.9 million. This contribution stays steady above $15 million, peaking in 2020 at $16.4 million before it gradually starts to decline. What's most notable in this graph is in 2037, that contribution drops significantly to $1.1 million. And if you recall the pie graph that showed the makeup of the contribution, it was the UAL payment, so the payment towards the unfunded liability that gets paid off, so to speak, at that date. So once the unfunded amount of benefits gets amortized, the plan will then just be paying the normal cost plus expected expenses. And the normal cost, again, that's the cost of benefits that are accruing, that are associated with the benefits accruing in a given year. So currently in the 2018 contribution, the normal cost is about $3 million, but in the future, as the active population in this plan declines, that normal cost will drop down to $1.1 million. In addition to focusing on contribution projections, it's also important to focus on the funded ratio of the plan. So what is the funded status? What are the assets compared to the liabilities? And as we saw in the historical charts, the assets are denoted by the line and the liability, the bars. We see again in 2018 that the current funded status of the plan is 58%. But over this projection period, the plan is projected to reach 100% funding, meaning that the assets will be in line with the amount of the liabilities, because the plan in place, the current funding policy of the plan, which continues to pay the accrual of benefits and continues to pay a payment for the unfunded, will meet the needs of the benefits and have enough assets to pay for benefits in the future, reaching 100% funded over the projection period. So to recap, what we've brought you here today is the current cost for the valuation at $15.9 million is approximately 1.95% higher than the prior year's contribution. The funded ratio remains stable at 58%. and given the closed nature of the plan, the active population continues to decline. In terms of the future projections, the cost will slightly increase in the next 4 years before declining, but it's important to understand that one of the main drivers of actual cost are those investment returns. And plan membership will continue to decline, and that investment horizon does get shorter and shorter as the active members left in the plan phase out through turnover. So that concludes, the remainder of the presentation has a few, some additional details, but that concludes the presentation at this point if there are any questions.
Thank you, and we do not have any speakers for this item, public speakers for this item. I'll open it up to the board. Are there any board members? Ms. Moreno. Councilmember Moreno.
So thank you for the presentation. Since the SDTC plan, since it's closed to new members and the actuary funding ratio was only 58.2%, doesn't this spell serious trouble?
Go ahead.
The slide of the funding.
There you go.
I think this is the slide that really the one of the two slides that really tries to we set this up back in 2012. So once we closed the plan, we knew our funded ratio, especially 3 years ago when we went from 7.5% to 7%, that actually reduced our funded ratio because your liabilities have increased. But we've had this plan in place since then to drive that funded ratio from 58% to 100% over the course of the next 20 years or so. And the previous slide, from a contribution standpoint, while we expect relatively stable levels of contributions, both from the employer and the employee, that is going to decline past that four-year period to when we get to 2037, and then our costs will go down to from about $14 million to one.
Sorry. Since we're not meeting our 7% threshold, doesn't that, and we might have to change that threshold, doesn't that mean that our ULI will actually go up?
The percentage will stay the same. It's what will happen is we will have to contribute more today because the assumed rate of return is going to be less. So the graph will stay relatively stable. I think it would just increase slightly, correct?
Right, it shifts up with those changes.
But the plan, regardless, is still, it would be right. The same plan. It's just, when do contributions take place?
Right.
Will it be a steeper decline in those out years? Or will, by paying more contributions today, or do we continue to stay with the plan where you have a more level contribution level until 2037, where it drops significantly?
And to clarify, that is the nature of the actual evaluation. It's self-correcting. So every year we're looking at, okay, did we meet our targets? If not, what do we have to do today to make sure that we're going to meet our target in the future? And when we have losses, we don't pay for them over like 30 years. We're paying for actual losses over 15 years so that we are addressing that issue. And we do that every year. And then, as we talked about, we also look at our assumptions to say, hey, we're not meeting these assumptions, and so we'll make changes if we see that that's what's expected in the future is not matching what our current assumptions are. And that's also a kind of correcting device to make sure that the plan is going to be on track to be paid up fully in 2037.
So how will a plan have enough assets to cover its liability?
Pardon me?
How will the plan have enough assets to cover its liabilities?
It's in the contributions. It's in the. We're assuming that the contributions are going to be made to the plan on this specific schedule. And based on that schedule and the fact that the plan we're anticipating will earn 7% right now.
But it's not earning 7% right
okay.
now.
Okay. So then every year that contribution, until we make changes to the assumption, every year that contribution will increase to adjust for that. For instance, last year the contribution was 15.6. And this year, because there was an asset loss, mm-hmm. the contribution increased to 500,000. And so that 500,000 is going to be paid for over the next 15 years. it's embedded into that 15.9 million. And so next year when we look at this, the 15.9 million is our starting point, and then any actuarial losses or gains, we will adjust that contribution. So it's, again, a self-correcting model. But if you do have returns always less than what you're expecting, you are going to see those losses. But like we said, we can reevaluate what that assumed rate of return is and adjust our target.
Can you go back to the other slide, the slide that you had where the number just drops down?
Maybe I can jump in and help to clarify. Can you pull up the pie chart with the amount we're contributing every year for the plan? Okay, so our normal cost is what we have to pay to the employees every year. The green part is a mortgage, so to speak, of the unfunded liability, a 20-year mortgage till 2037. Right. So we have an expected rate of return of 7%. If we only hit 5%, that's why the amount is going up by $500,000 this year. That mortgage is going to stay the same. It's almost like a variable interest rate, to think of it in that way. If 1 year variable, if interest rates go up, you're going to have to pay more in that next year. If they go down, if we exceeded it 7%, then our contribution would go down. But the green part is what the majority of our payment is, and these are MTS payments to the plan.
I understand.
So we will have enough to fund. This is why this was all set up, to guarantee that we will have enough to fund everybody who's retired under this plan. It will fluctuate every year. It might go up, it might go down, and it depends also on actuarial, if people live longer, if people live less, if life expectancy goes down, the amount of money we have to put in goes down. If it goes up, it goes up. But it will get paid. I don't want you to think that we're running risk of people not getting their pensions.
Can you go back to the other slide, the slide where the number just dips down? I'm not a pension expert, and this is my first meeting here, but that graph looks striking.
Right.
So, I mean, that's shocking to see the big dip.
So back in 2012, when the plan was closed, there were efforts taken to say it was amortized over 30 years, and then they decided to say, let's amortize our unfunded over 25 years. And so what the funding policy is currently is when we make any assumption changes, we align them with what's left of the years that are left for that 2012 big amortization payment. So every year, I think what we're down to maybe
It's 19 years.
So if we have an assumption change next year, let's say, we would amortize that over only 18 years so that it's in line with the funding policy to make sure that is paid off in 2037. And gains and losses on your assets or on your liabilities are even amortized over shorter periods. So that asset loss is going to be paid for in about 15 years.
So really, really quick, in 2037, that green slice on that pie chart
goes to zero.
That goes to zero. It's completely paid off in 19 more years. There's no more unfunded liability, and so all we'll have is that red piece will take up the majority of the pie chart with a small amount of administrative expenses. So that's why that chart is extremely striking, is because we have fixed the date in which the unfunded liability gets paid off.
It sounds like that green part of the graph is going to continue to grow, though, especially since we're not meeting our benchmark.
It's going to depend on a lot of factors. It's going to depend on mortality. It's going to depend on interest or rate of return on investments. That it will fluctuate.
Sounds like we have our work cut out for us here on this board.
Well,
just because the plan is closed, the proportion of the UAL payment to the normal cost will increase, because the normal cost is going to decrease every year because there are less actives. So you will see that proportion growing. The dollar amount, though, however, will depend on if there are gains or losses.
Okay, I'm not sure if it's Ms. Frank or Mr. McLean.
Yes. On this chart, on page 10, it shows that the cost for the agency is going to go from a little over 150 million up to almost 250 million. Wouldn't be smart to kind of average it out and put it at 200 million at this time, and then if we have some good years, we can decrease it a little bit. But that, the trouble is, we're going to be raising it every year.
That's actually not cost. Those are our market value of assets. So that's what we actually, those are the assets within the plan. So those assets will grow to a point in 2037 where your liabilities and your assets will be equal. And so you have a 100% funded plan in 19 years. So those, that's not costs. The previous slide was costs. This is your market value of assets, the investment assets that we hold.
Right. And the liabilities, right, and this graph are right now at 300 million. And those still aren't the cost of the plan, because the cost of the plan is what you're contributing every year right now. But those liabilities will increase just slightly over the next 5 or 10 years. And then you can see that they're starting to decline because the plan is closed and retirees will die and active members will retire and there'll be no more actives coming in to replace them. So you are going to see the liabilities decrease eventually. And open plans, you don't see this dynamic. What you see is the liabilities continuing to grow as well as the assets projected to grow as well.
But if we don't have a 7% return, it's going to grow every year. And we might, you know, it's about time for another recession here in the right. near future, and that would not be good for this plan. And I think we aren't contributing enough. I think we ought to put in more, but I'm only one person.
Councilmember Galvez.
Yes, how quickly could we see this chart, but with a 5% figure, rate of return figure?
Once we get an actuarial, we can do an investment study or a complete experience study, and we can bring that back to this body next mm-hmm. year. It's a very extensive, time-consuming process, and so we will go through the process of pulling all of the data. Go ahead.
Yeah, we can actually, and a lot of our plans do this, is just look at just the economic assumptions on an annual basis and keep the other assumptions on a five-year schedule, since those don't change as much and we really have very small liability gains and losses every year. It's really just in the assets that we're seeing more deviation. So we can just look at the economic assumptions if that's more palatable.
That would be helpful.
Thank you. I do not see any other board members. This is an action item, so I don't know if there's a motion to move the recommendation to contribute the amount of close to $16 million for the retirement plan. So, is there a motion?
I'll move it.
Thank you. Mayor Salas, is there a second?
I'll second that.
Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moves unanimously. Moving to item 45, which is a informational item related to the E Street Trolley Station in Chula Vista. And I will turn it over to staff.
Good morning. My name is Tim Allison. I'm the manager of real estate assets for MTS. With me is Kevin Pointer. He's a senior economic development specialist with the economic development department with the city of Chula Vista, and we're really excited to bring this informational item to the board today to highlight a joint effort between the city of Chula Vista and MTS to develop one of our trolley stations in the city of Chula Vista, along with a piece of property that the city of Chula Vista used to use for a corporation yard, a public works yard. And so let me move forward. So this slide will give you basically shows you the location of the property. On the very bottom of the slide is Interstate 5. F Street is on the right-hand side of the slide, and E Street is on the left-hand side of the slide. The yellow highlighted property is the MTS property. That's our E Street trolley station. And the green highlighted property is the former public works yard for the city of Chula Vista. So this slide will show you a little bit more about the F Street yard. It was a former public works yard, as I've mentioned. It's 6 acres. This property was taken out of service as a public works yard in 1999. And since then, the city has used it for several different types of activities. It was leased for a number of different types of tenants. The city also, in conjunction with MTS over the past 20 years, has been trying to develop this site for highest and best use. But those activities had not really come to fruition based on a lot of different reasons. The next slide shows you the MTS property. It's a little over four acres. We have 267 parking spaces there. We've got bus bays. We've got a small coffee shop that's on the site. It's a very active station, and we're pretty excited about this new opportunity. So this slide is a very telling slide of the proximity of these two properties to San Diego's bayfront. This is you can see to the very top is the bayfront area of the city of Chula Vista. It has been planned for a number of years to be able to redevelop that whole area. The city of Chula Vista has been negotiating a project with Gaylord to build a large hotel and convention center site. That has been finished, and they're going to start developing that site soon. So this site is also a gateway to the western part of the city of Chula Vista. The city has identified a number of different locations as gateways to their city, and E Street, F Street is one of them. Let me highlight a little bit about what the city has done to do land use upgrades for the site. It is part of the UC-15 district, which allows for mixed-use residential, office, and hospitality. And I'd like to highlight that this land use is the highest land use that is in the western side of the city of Chula Vista. It allows for an FAR, Florida Area Ratio, of 4 minimum to a maximum of 6. And building heights are allowable from 45 feet to a maximum of 210 feet. And that would basically look at a 4 to 20-story building in that location. So the city has really done a lot of work to be able to allow for dense development in this location. And right now, the economics and the climate in the city is right for us as a joint partnership to be able to develop the sites as a larger development that would allow for a better development to highlight the E Street trolley station as well as the gateway to the city of Chula Vista's western side. So the proposed strategy that we're moving forward with is to enter into a reimbursement agreement with the city of Chula Vista to share costs on consultants. The city had went through a RFQ process to hire economic and financial market services. They've identified 3 different firms that are eligible to do work for the city. And fortunately, one of them is Kaiser Marston & Associates. They have done extensive work with MTS in the past, and they've done work with the city of Chula Vista as well. And so the city is entering into a contract with Kaiser Marston to do the economic metrics that will be needed for the city as well as MTS to be able to determine what type of developments are going to be suitable for the site, what kind of return we're going to get, et cetera, et cetera. So with that reimbursement agreement, MTS would be liable up to $36,000 out of the $72,000 contract. And that one is going to start going forward quickly. Also, the idea is to move forward with the RFQ, RFP process to go out and solicit developers for the site, which would be a joint process between the city and MTS to really market this site and to get the best possible development we can for the property. So with that, since this is an information item, entertain any questions.
Thank you for that great, exciting presentation. We do not have any public speakers for this item. Board members? Mayor Salas. Yeah.
Well, you know, the city of Chula Vista is really excited to be working with MTS on this spectacular piece of property, and I think that this joint planning is the really smart way to do it, to make sure that we maximize return on this particular property, both for MTS and the city of Chula Vista. And I also want to thank our staff member Kevin here for being here today to represent the city. And I'd like to know, Kevin, do you have anything to say about this?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to present before you all this morning. Just to echo your statement, Madam Mayor, at your level, you all work together very well, and it trickles down and is infused at a staff level, too. And so as a staff member of one of your local jurisdictions, I'm very proud to be working alongside your MTS staff so that we can synergistically engage with development proposals and developers to jointly plan and develop both sites in a way that's going to maximize and achieve the objectives of both of our individual agencies and organizations. So thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Moreno.
Thank you to MTS staff, and thank you to the city of Chula Vista. This is a very exciting opportunity, and I'm pleased to see that MTS is partnering with the city of Chula Vista to produce more housing. As the chair of LUNH for the city of San Diego, my hope is that that this project can serve as a template for MTS to partner with other cities throughout the region to produce more housing. So thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember Galvez.
Thank you, hi Kevin. I was wondering if you could go back to the first slide in your presentation. Yes, right there, oh, either one. So there's been a number of citizens as well as employees in the city and other people are excited about this project that have asked about the edge of the circle of F Street right there. Can you tell us about that and what act of God it would take to make that part of this project, please?
Well, the turnout that you see on the very corner of the slide was to serve the freight service that went into the city of Chula Vista historically. That is now out of service. You can see, though, that there are traction power substations that are down in the corner that serve to power the trolley. So as we go forward with developing the site, we'll try to be able to maximize the footprint. But that's what those pieces were for.
And they could be moved easily or not?
The substations can't be moved easily. That's a really big process. The substations are sited to maximize the powering of the trolley. They're spaced out a certain period of certain locations. You just can't move them a couple of hundred feet because it's a very engineered process. So where those pretty much are set, and we'll try to see if there's any opportunities there, but I don't really see that those substations will be able to be moved.
So does that fall under MTS?
That's an MTS, yes.
MTS, not SDG&A,
no.
Just MTS. Okay, thank you.
But there are opportunities where we've built it into other developments, so there's some other treatments you could do to potentially build it into something.
And I would just point out that
there certainly is an opportunity to remove the abandoned freight tracks that are along that curve. Those don't need to stay. MTS has a capital project that will be coming to the board as part of the CIP for 2020 that is going to be going and looking at a lot of the areas in the city of San Diego, Chula Vista, and National City, where there are some abandoned freight tracks in the streets that we don't use, and to pave over those and remove those. So
then in a future drawing of this or schematic, could we draw a yellow line around that area and make it part of the project?
Absolutely.
And that's also part of our F Street Promenade study. So that also takes that into consideration. So that whole area right there with the F Street Promenade plan is going to be activated with bike lanes to go all the way from F to E Street.
In our next presentation, we can bring the F Street Promenade portion just to demonstrate to the board what's going on F Street as well.
That would be great. I do not see any other board members. Thank you for the presentation and definitely the exciting partnership and activating and hopefully creating dire need of housing for our region. So it's exciting. Moving on to 46, which is an update in the innovative clean transit regulations issued by CARB. Paul?
Yes, and I'm going to take this presentation since I've pretty much been spearheading the effort with CARB over the last almost 3 years on this rule. It's called the Innovative Clean Transit Regulation, the ICT regulation. It actually replaces the fleet rule for transit agencies that was adopted way back in 2000. The CARB board reviewed this in September, in late September, and the final rulemaking by CARB occurred on December 14th, 2018. So the major components of the ICT rule is that transit fleets are to be 100% zero emission bus by 2040. That could be with battery electric bus, it could be with hydrogen, it could be something else that comes about in the marketplace during that time. The purchase requirements will begin in either 2023 or 2025. I'll go over that in a minute, but if it happens in 2023, then for years 23, 24, and 25, 25% of all our bus purchases would have to be zero emission. 26, 27, 28, it would go up to 50%. And then after 2029, 100% of all our purchases would have to be zero emission. This only covers right now in this schedule the 40-foot regular transit buses, access buses, which we call cutaways, mini buses, and even articulated buses are excluded until 2026. And some of those, there is battery electric for articulated right now, but those are just coming out. But for small buses, especially cutaways and paratransit vehicles, there's not really any viable options for those. So they're going to be waiting on the technology. One of the things that we were looking for was benchmarking. There is no benchmarking provided for in the regulation. Benchmarking just means that we make these assumptions that this is going to work and it's going to work well. So you hold the regulation accountable to those assumptions. The board did not do that, but what they did do is that prior to implementation of all these years, a staff must come back to the CARB board and they must do their own analysis on where the industry and where the technology is going relative to the assumptions that they made. Another item of concern, obviously, is funding. And, you know, you've heard me talk about funding before. On buses alone, the six pilot buses that we're buying now are close to 900,000. The CNG buses are about 530 or so. So that HVIP funding through CARB of $150,000 a bus is important. Once this regulation in its passage, any zero emission bus made after a requirement date receives no incentive funding. If you buy them before, you will receive the incentive funding. Next. Going back to that either 2023 or 2025, there's kind of a statewide rule that we worked on with CARB.
if there's 850 buses purchased or in purchasing by 2023, then the requirement will be met for 2023. If by 2021 there's 1,250 buses, then that will meet the 2024 requirement. In any case, it will automatically start up again in 2025. A new component to it is that by July 1st of 2020, which is roughly in about a year and a half, we have to have a implementation plan prepared and approved by this board that we will send to CARB that will show how we will implement to the 2040 rule. It's also possible to join a consortium. I mean, we could technically join with LA and Orange County and North County and go for compliance that way. Some other major components of the rule, one of the positive things in the rule is that it does allow for what we call off-ramps, at least for a temporary stay to the requirements, but they're only 1 year at a time. And those are when the infrastructure needed to support ZEBs can't be built in time, and infrastructure, charging infrastructure for urban transit fleets, is still a big issue that needs to be designed and built. There currently is not in the United States any 200-bus operation that has a charging infrastructure in place in an urban environment like IAD or KMD. When the available zero-emission buses can't achieve the mileage needed to operate the service. So, for example, right now, the state-of-the-art is about 170-mile range. That would cover about 60% of our routes right now, that we would be able to charge, go out for 170 miles, and then come back in without replacing it mid-route. So this is kind of a check on that. If we get to a point at some point where range does not exceed our mileages, we can petition for that until the technology does. Also, topography. We also know that range is significantly affected by hills, et cetera, and there are some hilly places, not so much in, there is in San Diego, but other places have more topographical challenges. When buses are not available that can be configured to meet all state, federal, and local laws, and primarily the biggest one there is weight. As battery density gets higher, in order to extend the range of the buses, they get much heavier. And so there's only about five states in the country that have an exemption for bus weights. We do not in California. We actually negotiated it a few years ago to considerably expand the weights, and there is an excess weight allowed for zero emission, but as battery density increases and weights on bus increases, that could be impacted. And the final one is if there's a financial hardship, and that would have to be something that would have to be shown and approved by the board. A couple of other things with the ICT rule. By January 2020, bus purchases, if you're not buying a battery electric, if you're buying still, for example, like CNG, they must purchase the Cummins low NOx engine. For you new members of the board, this is especially good for us. We helped Cummins develop that engine. For many of you that know, San Diego was one of the first in the country to go CNG. So we helped to pioneer that technology going back almost 20 years ago. So we helped Cummins with this new engine. We're already buying that engine, so this is something that we're already in compliance with. Also, by January 2020, anybody who's buying CNG must buy renewable CNG, or as we call it, green gas. We are already doing that. We are already 100% buying green gas, and we have been for several years now in our agreement with BP. Um, And I already talked about the one-year report to the board in terms of if technology is meeting what their assumptions were. So that's just a really quick overview. We have, for the new board members, we have a pilot that we're doing. The buses have already been ordered. They're going to be starting in construction pretty soon. It's an initial six. We're probably looking for some more after that, at least a couple more battery electrics and possibly some hydrogen. We have a contractor, CTE, who is our consultant on this whole thing that will help us devise the pilot program for testing of these battery electrics, for reporting the results, and helping us to develop the plan as well as the charging infrastructure. And we had an item last month where we brought in a we brought in a scheme. It was this is a pretty mild one. The other one was a little bit more bold, but this is what we're proposing. It's essentially our bus right now, but done in a real bright green with across the top with its what is it? Clean electric, right? Quiet clean electric. Across the top. So that's what we're going to go with. We still have to determine whether we're going to paint it or we're going to wrap it, because at some point in time we're going to be all red again. They're going to be all electric, and this is not about changing our image or our logo or anything else. So we've still got to work out those issues. We may paint these initial ones, but so we've got to go with that. So I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. We do have two public request for this item, Ms. Newsom, and following will be Jack Shu. And you will have 2 minutes.
Thank you. First and foremost, welcome and congratulations to the new board members. It's great to see so many new faces around this board. Next, I'm sorry, my phone just died. And then, of course, that happens. But you gave me 2 minutes, so it's all okay. So I'm Gretchen Newsom, speaking on behalf of IBEW 569 and our 3,200 members. And we were big supporters of the innovative clean transit rule when it was coming before CARB. And we are also big supporters of transitioning to clean zero-emission buses and the many public health, climate, and ridership benefits. And as MTS maps out and implements the innovative clean transit rule, we are looking forward to collaborating together to ensure a skilled, qualified electrical personnel are performing the work related to this new initiative, with particular emphasis on safety. And if any of the board members have not yet come to our San Diego Electrical Training Center to see what we are doing to train the next generation of electricians in all the new green technologies, including this, including making sure that all of our apprentices and our current membership that are journeymen are coming back to the hall to get what's known as their EVITP certifications, we would be more than happy to lead a tour for you. And EVITP stands for Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Training Program. So we are making sure that all of them are well-trained and well-equipped to be your workforce. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack Shu?
Hi, Jack Shu with the Cleveland National Forest Foundation. And in this case, since there's no representative from Sierra Club who have supported this statewide, I wanted to kind of say a word for them as well. The benefit of speaking after Gretchen is you don't have to hear from me. I'll just repeat, you know, pretty much what she would say, or at least reiterate her. The only thing I'm going to add in is I go to China as a tourist often for a long time. There was a time when I went and in which literally donkeys went and carts, and but within a very short period of time, they went to CNG. And then most recently, the last few years, I've been going electric buses. They buy 100,000 electric buses a year or more. And I saw them working. I rode them. They work quite well. So I think this is a transition we can make. The technology is going to catch up. And my one last thing is, I think if we have a priority, let's put these electric buses in the communities that are impacted the most by poor air quality. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one request, and I'm trying to make up the name. Lorraine Lane. Sorry about that. I couldn't make up. You have 2 minutes.
This is all right. Okay.
Okay.
I had a question. Can we go back to the picture of the bus, please? A common earlier question, how do you phrase it? Okay, with the MTS goes green, that's fine. My question, comment is, when you guys order those, how is that going to affect the cutaway buses with the disabled ramp being put in the back? Is it possible to have it put in the front like the rest of the buses? That's my question or comment.
Well, the disabled buses are not going to be battery electric now. So cutaways and paratransit are not. These are only 40 footers, so that's what it looks like.
So they're going to be able to have the ramp that comes out?
You can make your statement, and if there are any specific questions, staff can speak to you offline.
Okay, yeah.
This is not a Q&A, so you can deliver your statement.
Just ask him why he's got it up, that's why.
Okay, thank you. Vice Chair Rios.
Thank you. I just want to say that I think the design on the MTS Go Green is much better, and I know that we're not going to be branding it that way, but I just think that looks much better than what we saw originally. So thank you to staff. I also wanted to just make a comment on the ICU rule. I know that there's exemptions out there, but I think, you know, we as a board need to be cognizant of the fact that we need to make sure that we're moving forward in terms of the infrastructure and also some of the funding measures we have to do regarding the battery, so that we are moving towards those deadlines, so that we can achieve that, which includes the skilled electrical personnel that are certified. I think that's important to all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I do not see any other committee members, so we're going to move on, trying to move it quickly. We still have a closed session informational item. So related to 15-9, we do have several speakers to this item. And I'm skipping 47. Let me go back to 47, the operations budget status report. Sorry about that, Mike.
Good morning. I'm presenting the operating budget status report for the first 5 months of the year through November 30th, 2018. We typically start with operating revenues for our new board members. Operating revenues is basically two components. It's fare revenues from our passengers and other operating revenues. Our fare revenues are actually very close to budget for the first 5 months. We've had issues with declining ridership for the last couple of years, so this number is always top of mind for our agency, and we are just 0.8% under budget, but as you can see in the bullets below, we are actually ahead year over year, so we are seeing growth both on revenue for the year over year and also on passengers very slightly year over year. So that is a positive number. We're looking forward to see how that goes for the rest of the year. Other operating revenue is things like advertising and energy credits and rent lease revenue and things like that. That is actually trending very favorable for the first 5 months of the year. We're ahead by $800,000 over that period. That is primarily being driven by energy credits at the state level. The prices of energy credits are much higher than we initially projected. That's driving that favorable variance. So overall, operating revenue is $500,000 or 1.1% favorable for the first 5 months.
So Mike, before, I'm just going to, can you go back really quickly? I just really want to make sure that we don't miss this because we have been in the news about losing ridership. So I just want to make the point on the fare revenue related to the first bullet. That is due because there's been an increase in ridership.
We're barely over last year's number, so we're not going down yet. So
I just want to make sure that that is an important point that we should not miss.
Right, and revenue is increasing year over year as well, so we hope to see that continue. On the expense side, most of the expenses are fairly close to budget for the first 5 months. We do have a large unfavorable variance on the energy line. That is primarily due to the cost of electricity in July and August when we had those heat waves, and the actual cost of the commodities spiked to very high levels. So that continues to be a variance. We hope that levels off as we go through the course of the year, but we'll have to keep an eye on that. We also have an unfavorable variance in purchase transportation. Everything else is fairly close to budget. So for the first 5 months, we're $421,000 unfavorable, 0.4% unfavorable variance. Then when you look at both things combined, we are ahead of plan at this point. We're ahead of plan by $99,000 or 0.1%, so positive news for the first 5 months. There are a number of things we tend to keep a closer eye on, like passenger revenue and passenger levels for one. These are what we call our ongoing concerns, and it's generally things that can have a big impact on our operating budget. The first is regional sales tax receipts. The regional sales tax receipts drives both our TDA revenue and our Transnet revenue. So we tend to keep an eye on that. As at this point, we do believe we'll hit the initial projections for the year. So we have no concerns on that line. State transit assistance funding is another area that has been a major concern in the past, with funding disappearing for years at a time. It's been more stable of late, and then with the passage of SB 1 a couple years ago and the repeal effort failing in November, we can count on these revenues. As you can see, we expect large favorable variance within SB 1 this year because we didn't plan to use any because we didn't know how that election would turn out. So we will be bringing that back to the Budget Development Committee when we have those first meetings about how to spend that SB 1 money. And even the base formula STA that we've been receiving for a number of years, that is coming in higher due to the price of the price and usage of diesel gasoline across the state. So we do expect a favorable variance in that line as well. Passenger levels we talked about, we hope to hit our budget number. We're fairly much on target so far. And then on the energy side, the main numbers to worry about here is CNG, our natural gas costs, and then electricity. Those are by far the biggest expense line items on here. We also do purchase propane and a very little bit of diesel and a very little bit of gasoline, but it's primarily CNG and electricity. Electricity, we had an issue with the commodity prices earlier in the year. They have settled back down a little bit, so we'll see how that comes in at the end of the year. But then on natural gas side, we do have favorable rates so far, and we expect that to be favorable. So hopefully those two can balance each other out at the end of the year. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
We don't have any public requests for this item. Are there any questions from the board? Excellent presentation. Thank you. So with that, we're moving forward with the report related to the ad hoc ballot measure. We do have several speakers for this item. I'll ask that you please keep your testimony short. Just because of due to time, but we'll have plenty of discussion in the near future on this item. This is just informational, just for the board. We have created a new ad hoc committee member based on the new members that have come in. We're going to be having a meeting soon. One of the things that the previous ad hoc committee did was we worked on putting together the entire team that will be helping us develop this potential measure that will come to the board to make a final decision. So that's something that we've been working on. One of the number of things now that we have the full team is we've been working on crafting a initial poll that we hope to have it be on the streets in the next couple of weeks, and that really is to just start gauging the appetite on moving this ballot to the future voters and to bring that information to the rest of the board. Exploring a half-cent sales tax, hopefully, for the near future ballot. In terms of engagement, or in terms of actually one of the things that we also been looking at is initial projects that will be, some of them will be pulling, some of them not, because there's only so much we can pull. But I know that some of the items that we've been hearing are the purple line, so that is part of the pull. Innovative safety and bathroom stations throughout, improving the infrastructure in our trolley stations as well as in our buses, enhancing frequency in trolleys. Also enhancing bus-only lanes related to rapid services. We're also looking at the connectivity to the airport and then improving some of our transit lines to have it be 24-hour service. And we're also looking at youth opportunity passes. And there are many other things that are being looked at as well. That's just a major overall areas that we're looking at. The poll we're hoping to finalize this week, and like I said, this is just an initial poll that will give us a little bit more direction and how to craft a measure that, once again, will be brought to the board hopefully later in the year. In terms of the timeline, poll will be going, the initial poll will be going to some of the voters early February. Then the outcome of that will be discussed at the ad hoc committee. Part of the outreach process will be in March related to creating focus groups, a possible stakeholder working group as well. That's something that will be discussed at that ad hoc committee, but just wanting to make sure that we are engaging the public, all the necessary stakeholders that we need to ensure that everybody's involved from the get-go. And then all of that is going to transcribe in creating a measure that will be brought to the board to either give it its thumbs ups or not, or we're not going forward. So that's part of the discussions and the developments that the ad hoc committee, along with the public and along with various different polls that will be moving forward. So that is the overall what's been going on, what we're hoping to do, and eventually coming to the full board for direction if we are moving forward. So with that, I'm going to start calling the public, and I do ask that you please, you will have 2 minutes. Don't need to use the full 2 minutes. So with that, Vianney Rubalcaba, I believe, and following would be Jack Hsu.
Good morning. My name is Vianney Rubalcaba, and I'm the Transportation and Planning Program Coordinator at the City Heights Community Development Corporation. And our organization is proud to be co-founders of a new group called the San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group, which was formed to identify transportation projects and policy priorities rooted in our work with resident groups from communities like City Heights, National City, and Barrio Logan. Our organization is excited to begin this partnership with other orgs working to reduce barriers to transit access and improve our region's transportation system. City Heights has been one of the areas with the highest public transit ridership in the region, and we're looking forward to seeing more transit projects and service improvements that benefit this community. The priority projects identified by our working group include the Rapid Route 625, formerly known as Route 550, the Purple Line Trolley, transit-only lanes on the 94 into downtown, a new centerline station on the 94 at 25th Street, serving the Rapid Lines 225 and 235, and a Blue Line Express with 24-hour service to and from the border, along with safety and comfort improvements at transit stops and stations, and greater affordability through the Youth Opportunity Pass. Although not all of these projects are in City Heights, they improve the regional network as a whole and improve mobility for environmental justice communities. The San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group has submitted to the board a letter including a list of these project priorities that address transportation justice needs. We encourage the board and staff to consider these projects and policy priorities as you look to improve service and begin new projects. And thank you to the board and Chair Gomez for addressing these projects already. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack Hsu. Following Jack would be B. Mittermiller.
Hello, Jack Hsu with the Cleveland National Forest Foundation. Well, last month, I presented to the board a list of questions that need to be answered, that need to be addressed before we go forward with any proposed bond measure. Today, I just want to support a letter from the Quality of Life Coalition to you with regards to what kind of process we need to enter into as we deal with bond measures. Particularly with a regressive tax, we need to change things. You are elected here to change things. And what I'm dismayed is a process of putting a bond measure onto a ballot using the same kinds of methodology that SANDAG did in the past, a failed system. And in fact, putting projects forward using a failed modeling system that we've proven in court at SANDAG. We need a vision before we need to go forward. We need a different kind of thought process. So I'll come back with some of those questions more in detail in the future, but for now, please listen to other members of the communities from the coalition saying, you know, let's change our methodologies here. We failed in the past. Let's not fail again, particularly if we're going to tax the poor to pay for the system. Thank you.
Following B will be Gretchen Newsom.
Good morning, Chairwoman Gomez and board members. My name is Bea Mittermiller. I'm a volunteer with San Diego 350, an organization that represents San Diego County and works to fight climate change. We are partners with the Quality of Life Coalition, which Jack mentioned already, and also part of the Transportation Equity Working Group. And we support their stands regarding the ballot measure ad hoc committee. One thing I wanted to speak to particularly was the issue of transparency and public input. I think this is essential for the success of the ballot measure. With input from communities in the metropolitan transit system service area, the prospects of any measure passing will increase with this kind of input. The current riders, largely low income and people of color, depend on the system to access employment. These riders are your customers and they need a better system. Others in the county who drive their own cars, often alone, need an improved system to provide an attractive alternative, not only to reduce congestion, but to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which are the primary threat to us all. We want to help MTS succeed, and so we hope that you will take our proposal to make the ad hoc committee public seriously. Thank you very much.
Following Gretchen will be Sophie Wolfer.
Thank you. With respect to time, I'll just note that we are also coalition members. We've submitted a letter. We've outlined some of those priorities. Please review the letter, and we are hopeful that you're going to develop a very public process with a lot of transparency around this ballot measure, and we are looking forward to collaborating and partnering with you on it. Thank you.
Morning. Sophie Wolfram with Climate Action Campaign. We see a lot of opportunity in a revenue measure at MTS to increase ridership and reduce VMT and greenhouse gas emissions and meet the needs of transit riders by making transit more frequent, more convenient, more affordable, and to achieve other key quality of life indicators through this measure. But for the measure to gain the widespread public support needed to pass and ensure it actually delivers the public benefits I mentioned, it needs to be developed from the beginning through a transparent, responsive public process. In a letter that a couple of others we have mentioned that we submitted by email to the board from members of the Quality of Life Coalition, we've asked that moving forward, the ballot measure committee meets in publicly noticed open meetings. At least two seats on that committee are community seats so that members of the public have ongoing input directly into the decision-making process, and that MTS establish a community advisory committee parallel to the ballot measure committee, as the chair mentioned, the board's looking at doing. So we're happy to hear that. The early stages, I really want to emphasize, the early stages of measure development are in many ways the most crucial. This is when we should be asking key questions like, what are we trying to do with this revenue that MTS raises? Who will benefit? And what are the greatest needs in the system? And you need input from the public, especially from people who use the system and are most knowledgeable about it, to help answer those questions. So we hope today can act as kind of a kickoff to move forward with meaningful public participation in the development of this measure. We're happy to partner with the board and staff in hammering out the details, but it's critical that this moves forward quickly because the development of the measure has been moving for quite some time. Thank you.
Thank you. Rosa Alascoga, following would be Ana Castro Reynoso.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rosa Olascuaga, and I'm a community organizer with Mid-City CAN. I'm here with coalition partners with the Quality of Life as well with the San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group. I'm here to ensure that the 2020 ballot measure process is transparent and guarantees communities' input. I'm asking you all to just move the ad hoc committee ballot to a public committee, because at the end of the day, the community needs to be involved in the process. We're the ones that ride the bus, we're the ones that are using it the most, and we could give you more insight of what's going on and what we need. So then we just want to make sure that this committee is transparent as much as it could possibly be. A polling is not enough. Focus groups are not enough. You need to make sure that you have the community in the same place as these board members, as these measures are developing, to make sure we have that input, we have that equality, when we have that access to those that voice so you could have that access to the community of who rides the transportation and who uses transportation. So again, please take action and do convert this committee as a public committee. We really would appreciate that, and we really want to work together with you all. Thank you.
So my name is Ana Castro Reynoso, and today I will be speaking with you regarding the San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group priority projects and policies for the MTS 2020 ballot measure. I'm a representative from this group, and as the Transportation Justice Advocate and Environmental Health Coalition, I also represent 8,000 residents in the San Diego region. So we are the San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group, and we are composed of community-based organizations, and we are Environmental Health Coalition, Center on Policy Initiatives, San Diego 350, City Heights Community Development Corporation, and Mid-City CAN. And we're dedicated to transportation justice in the region. We also all agree that transportation justice should be held as the most critical guiding value in the creation of this ballot measure. In the city of San Diego, families and environmental justice communities depend on transit 3 times more compared to the city overall. This is in the city of San Diego again. And according to MTS staff, low-income communities are MTS's number one customer, making up approximately 70% of MTS's transit riders. Yet for MTS's best customer, riding the bus or the trolley is very expensive and inefficient. This is evidenced by a Brookings Institute study that shows only 29% of jobs in the MTS service area are accessible within 90 minutes. This sounds a little hard to understand, but basically it means is even if you're willing to sit for an hour and a half on various buses and trolleys just to get to work one way, you would still only be able to get to 29% of jobs in the region. And so this infographic represents that disparity. The green little squares are the jobs that would be accessible within 90 minutes, and red are the ones that would not be. So what is the solution? We know that when the region leads with equity-centered solutions, everyone benefits. And four of the sort of several ways that MTS can do that is by ensuring connection from environmental justice communities to jobs, making it affordable to ride the bus or the trolley, ensuring the region meets its required state and climate targets, as well as ensuring that the ballot measure process is transparent and guarantees meaningful community engagement. So in our letter that we sent to you all back in December, and you also have a copy of in front of you, we propose a specific network of priority transportation justice projects and policies for the ballot measure. So again, this list is defined more in more detail in the letter, and you can see more detail on the environmental justice impact of each one of these. And so the proposed network is really a community-led initiative that addresses access to jobs, accessibility to public transportation, et cetera. And so we split our proposal into both projects and policies because we understand the need to maintain our current system as well as build out with short and long-term goals at the same time. And more specifically, our proposed policies, like you can see here, address how MTS defines environmental justice communities geographically, the affordability, efficiency, and safety of the system, community involvement in the process and implementation, and as well as building out infrastructure to reduce emissions from buses, and they're referring to the innovative clean transit rule. Then you also see on the other side a map of all the projects that we're proposing. So for example, we propose youth opportunity passes to address affordability. And these are no-cost transit passes for students and youth up to 24 years old, and reduced transit fares for seniors, disabled riders, and veterans. Some of the projects include the Blue Line Express, the Purple Line, and the Rapid 625. And these are projects that we really believe can be implemented towards a both short and long-term strategy. And we also propose expanded late-night hours of trolley and bus routes to address the efficiency of the system and create a future where the public transportation system can compete with the car in San Diego. And we also encourage that, again, you change the ad hoc committee to a public committee so that the community who will be voting on this measure can provide their input. And this network of policies and projects are the result of many, many years of community organizing and advocacy at SANDAG, at MTS. These are projects that community members have been wanting for a very, very long time, and we believe their voices should be part of the process. And so lastly, once again, we know that when equity and community are at the center, everyone benefits. And MTS now really has a unique opportunity that has never happened in San Diego to be the region's climate champion and transform San Diego's transportation system to ensure that environmental justice communities like City Heights, Barrio Logan, National City, Southeast San Diego, and San Isidro are the top priorities for mass public transit service. So we ask that you take seriously the voices of the community throughout this process, and we really look forward to working with you to include these projects and policies and move forward together. And these are the logos of our organizations. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Following will be Esperanza Miranda, Lorraine Layton, and finally, Dr. Peter Brownell.
Buenos días.
Good morning.
Mi nombre es Esperanza González y soy promotora de HC, de la Coalición de Salud Ambiental.
Good morning. My name is Esperanza González. I have worked for the Transportation Justice City of San Diego and advocating for public transit.
Residente de City Heights.
Resident of City Heights.
He trabajado para la justicia de transporte público en City Heights por muchos años.
I have worked for the Transportation Justice in City Heights for many years.
Soy de las personas que trabajé para colectar firmas para la AB 805.
I'm one of the persons that helped collect signatures for AB 805.
Ley que permite a MTS que le permite a MTS recolectar sus propios fondos para el transporte público.
This bill allows MTS to obtain funds for public transit.
Hoy estamos aquí para apoyar las propuestas de la coalición de equidad.
Today I'm here to support the transportation justice projects and policies proposed by the San Diego Transportation Equity.
A las comunidades nos gustaría tener servicio las 24 horas.
To our communities, we would like to see 24-hour service.
Servicio más frecuente.
Frequent service.
Y más seguridad.
And more security.
La seguridad es fundamental para crear un sistema.
Security is fundamental to create a system.
De transporte público.
Public transport.
Para todos.
For all.
Por favor, incluyan estas prioridades al crear
please make sure
la medida MTS.
These priorities to create the MTS ballot measure.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Good morning, board, and welcome to the new board to the MPS. My name is Lorraine Layton. I represent the disabled public, and I live in El Cajon, California. And I'd like to talk to Bob McClellan after the meeting and Nathan Fletcher after your closed session. I had a few things to say, and one is with your MTS proposal for the ballot. What would happen if you guys were to sit there and put on the ballot and tell the public the real truth as to why you have to raise or lower the fares, as in the new buses and how much it's going to cost? That it's state mandatory, number one. You can't get out of it, so it's like, okay. So that they know. And the other issue is, lately we've been having a lot of, drug dealings at El Cajon Transit Station. Since they passed the marijuana law and that, not only have they had that going on at the same time, but they have also had the e-cigarettes going at the same time, as well as smoking, and nobody's done a thing about it. And I thought it should be brought to your attention. And the rest I'll send in a letter and address it to not only to Paul, because it involves him, but also the rest of the board. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Brownell? I believe he's left. Okay. So with that concludes the public comment on this item. Are there any board members?
I'd like to say something.
Yes, go.
Sure. So first I'd like to, of course, thank all of the community members and stakeholders who are here today to speak on this item. I share your enthusiasm and on shaping this MTS ballot. I also would like to say that the partnership of the stakeholders will be a key to making this a success. It will also include meaningful public participation that will build support for the future. So I do support making this as transparent, including the ad hoc committees, making them public. In regards to the projects that were mentioned earlier by the chair, I'd like to thank the San Diego Transportation Equity Working Group for coming forward with the list that they developed. And in addition to what was mentioned, I look forward to also working for the Blue Line Express and also the expanding of the 24-hour trolley line that will include a service that connects us from the border to downtown. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Thank you to the public. To be continued related to this item, like as I said at the beginning, is the beginnings. There will be plenty of community input beyond even the people that were here today. It is going to require a lot of folks to be lined up to make this happen. So trust when I say this will be a very transparent process before the board makes any decision if we are going to be moving forward with the ballot. To be continued. So with that concludes our regular agenda today. So we're going to go into closed session, but there are no other agenda items for today's agenda. Thank you.
Starting out of closed session, item 24A on pending litigation, the board received a report from legal counsel.